One of the key ways the Buddha described the understanding of emptiness is that experience is empty of self or what belongs to self. And one of the key teachings around the aggregates is that we tend to confuse the experience around the aggregates interpret the experience around the aggregates as a sense of self, as a self. And so I'd like to explore this, both two sides of this exploration of not self. We could say, let's explore the teaching around what the Buddha said about not self a little bit. And then something about what it is we are misinterpreting. What is the process and what's going on in our minds that we are misinterpreting experience to be a self? And so, not self and selfing. So the first piece I'll read from, this is from the Majjhima 2, and it describes how an ordinary person relates to experience, and basically the Buddha says that an ordinary person doesn't understand what's useful to pay attention to. So an ordinary person does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, they attend to those things unfit for attention and do not attend to those things fit for attention. This is how they attend unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else they are inwardly perplexed about the present, thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where is this being come from? Where will it go? When they attend unwisely, one of six views arises. The view self exists for me arises as true and established, or the view no self exists for me arises as true and established, or the view I perceive self with self, or the view I perceive not self with self. That's a good one. Or the view I perceive self with not self arises. Or else they have some such view as this. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and now the results of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. This is called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, an untaught ordinary person is not freed from suffering. And so basically we suffer caught by a perspective that the Buddha is pointing to. These perspectives are a key part of how and why we suffer. They're intimately tied up with how and why we suffer. And note that he points out different views around self, including I have no self, being a view that is a view of self. So this is a subtle teaching, this view of not self, which I like Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation of this anatta as not self rather than no self. Because it's more of a sense of what we take to be self, it is not that. So some kind of ways in a more kind of conventional ways or more just descriptive ways to understand perhaps something of what the Buddha is pointing to in saying that what we take to be self is not that. The whole exploration that we've been making around exploring the conditioned nature of the aggregates, the impermanent nature of the aggregates, the insubstantial nature of the aggregates, points us to seeing that what's happening is a process. Everything that arises is arising in dependence on other experience. Conditions change. The flux of experience happens. And we even start to see at times that what we think of as a thing isn't really a thing. That things don't exist in the way we think they do. And there's just this endless transformation. No experience, no one moment the same as the previous moment. So this flux. And so this is one pointing to this understanding, because what we take, usually we take something, we take a self to be something that is a thing, as something that is stable, that is persisting from one moment to the next. And what we see in observing the aggregates, the entirety of our experience, is there is nothing that is stable from one moment to the next. So where could a self actually be? Now, there's nothing that we can pin down in this stream of experience to say, this is me. This is who I am. In the second discourse the Buddha gave, it's one of the key teachings in which he offers and describes both this confusion around the sense of self in the aggregates and a kind of a beginning to undermine the beliefs there and to ask us to begin to explore a little bit. So the first thing, this is the second discourse of the Buddha, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the characteristic of not self. And the structure of the sutta uses the five aggregates as a framework for exploring our experience, for exploring not only our experience, but this sense of self that seems to be there. And the first thing the Buddha points to, he comes out and he says, for each of the aggregates, he says, form is not self, feeling is not self, perception is not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. And he goes on to say, or kind of unpack a little bit, using reflection and using kind of our sense of what a self would be. So he says, form is not self. If form were self, then the body would not lend itself to affliction, and it would be possible to determine of the body, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus. But because form is not self, body leads to affliction, It is not possible to say, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus. And he says that of all of the aggregates. Feeling is not self. If feeling were self, it would be possible to say a feeling, may my feeling be thus. Wouldn't that be nice? We see this all the time, this uncontrollability. And so this is really pointing to the uncontrollable nature of the aggregates of our experience. And we know this, but we mistake it. We think in some way that because I don't have control, it means I'm failing. I mean, I hear this sometimes, and some of you have described seeing this sense of, oh, I can't make my experience be this way. I must not be meditating properly. As opposed to recognizing, can't make my experience be this way. It's not self. And so this very ordinary experience that we have all the time of seeing that can't make body be what I want it to be, can't make feelings be what I want it to be, is evidence for this truth of not self. It's staring us in the face all the time, but instead we interpret it and feel like something's wrong. So this sense of control, this agency, this aspect of agency, of having control, I make things happen. This is a very common way of having a sense or a feeling of the sense of self, that I do these things, I choose, I act. So this notion of agency, there's this notion of agency in connection to the feeling of self very often. And so here the Buddha is pointing to the fact of the uncontrollability of experience. It's not a problem. It's actually something to open our minds to wisdom about. This is pointing to the not-self nature of experience. For each of the aggregates, if you find yourself, you know, why am I not able to make this thing happen? It's like, oh, not self. That's why. The next part of the sutta, the next part, the structure of the sutta, again, for each of the aggregates, the Buddha goes through and says, form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, mental formation's impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. And we've been exploring this in the last days, looking at the arising and passing of various experiences as a way in, and you know, the Buddha pointing to this as being an important reflection around the aggregates, noticing their impermanence. And again, he's actually in conversation with a group of monks at this point, and he says, what do you think? Is form permanent or impermanent? That's impermanent. Okay. Check. And likewise with the other ones. Now, when we get to consciousness, that one's a little harder. I mean, we can kind of begin to see, yeah, feeling's impermanent. We see feeling come and go. Perception's impermanent. Body's impermanent, but, you know, it's much more the recognition of the changing, kind of, yeah, see ourselves aging, see that we do die. So, you know, we know this. We know the impermanence of form, feeling, perception, and mental formations too. I mean, there's a way in which we can kind of grok, at least at an intellectual level, the impermanent nature of those. I find it much harder and seems to be much generally harder to grok the impermanent nature of consciousness, as we've been talking about, that kind of sense of consciousness as being very stable. And yet, You know, he was talking to a group of people who seemed to have a fair amount of understanding and who said, yes, consciousness is impermanent. So they were on board with him. You know, they were following this line of logic, at least. And so then he points out, he says, so what is impermanent is unreliable. It's not a place where we can find lasting happiness. Experience, whatever's arising, not a place we can kind of finally say, yes, that's what's going to do it for me, because it is destined to change. And so the happiness that we find in dependence on changing experience is destined to not be a reliable happiness. And then the Buddha goes on to say, and this is something that may be a little bit of a not necessarily something that we would necessarily kind of follow the logic of this, but he said, it doesn't make sense to call something that is impermanent and unreliable a self. And we may or may not kind of follow that line of thinking. But there was kind of a more, I'd say, in the time of the Buddha, there was a certain class of thinkers that thought that what they were looking for was this kind of emerging with a kind of a great self that was permanent and blissful. And so that was a kind of a definition in a way of what, not the ordinary self, but the self that would be the ultimate happiness, is this merging or some kind of permanent blissful state. And so the Buddha is pointing to, in experience, there is nothing to be found that could remotely qualify for that, what that definition of self. And yet what I think of this reflection here, he says, well, what do you think? Does it make sense to call what is impermanent and unreliable a sense of self? To me, this is kind of an invitation in a way to explore, well, what do we take to be self? You know, he's exploring with this group of people what they take to be self, perhaps this permanent, blissful something, and kind of beginning to look at it, investigate it, be curious about, is this findable here? In that other text that I read, there's so many different ways that this view of self is experienced. It's, you know, is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions? So this self of mine experiences suffering, and yet it persists as long as eternity. So this sounds like a slightly different view of self than this permanent, blissful self. So I just wanted to point that out. But to me, this piece of the text asks us to investigate, what do we call self? What are we taking to be self? And begin to explore, is it worthy? Does it make sense to call it a self? Does it exist in the way that we think it does? What are the attributes we think that sense of self has? And does it actually live up to that? And so this is where I like to take the exploration. Not so much to try to find not self, you know, to figure out, is there not self here? That is, I perceive not self with this self. But it does make sense to be curious about, what is it that I'm calling self? So this turns the exploration around from to, you know, instead of trying to see not self, to understanding what the mind is imputing to be self. So this calls up to my, in my mind, the famous Dogen quote. To study the way is to study the self. Understand what we are calling self. To study the self is to forget the self. And so this to me points to, with the study, with the curiosity, with the investigation, the understanding that grows as we explore, what is this sense of self? Does it have the qualities that are being attributed to it? That is the wisdom that develops with that helps the mind to recognize the misperception, the misunderstandings that are functioning in there. This is the magic show, this weaving of a sense of self. And then Dogen continues, to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. And every now and then we get a taste of that, what that means. That those times when the sense I am or the sense of self falls away and there is just seeing and just hearing and just body sensation and thoughts, emotions coming and going. No I here, but all experience known as just arising and passing. So getting familiar with what we think of as a sense of self experientially. So an investigation, a curiosity about that. Sometimes we might witness this whole investigation is lots of different ways in and lots of different flavors of it. Sometimes we kind of come into awareness of a sense of self that's kind of been hanging out for a while and we're in the midst of it, but we wake up into it and we can see something about that, you know, maybe the constriction around it or the struggle with it, the beliefs, the identity, the sense of identity, the sense of I'm right, or whole host of qualities that can come in that as we wake up in the middle of it, one that has kind of been tumbling along for a while, we can wake up and recognize the, wow, there's a real strong identification going on here. Sometimes we might see actually a sense of self arising. You know, the kind of coming into being of a sense of self, and then we begin to understand something about some of the things we impute to self. And I'd say a lot of what we impute to self is this sense of indurability, this sense of something stable over time. Or there might be times when we see a sense of self vanishing, falling away, and then understand something about the confusion that we had been hooked into. On one retreat, I was having a meal and I was kind of miserable. And the miserableness had been kind of going along for a little while. And the mindfulness hooked into it, noticed it, recognized it. And there was a sense of knowing that miserableness and the kind of sense of I'm miserable. And then in noticing that I was practicing with knowing miserable, there was this sense of, oh, I'm a practicing yogi, that kind of replaced the sense of I am miserable. And then I got confused. And that was another me, another sense of self. And this all happened within the space of about a minute, you know, boom, boom, these different senses of self. And, you know, just the sense of the confusion came because it's like, what? A minute ago, I was miserable. And now I'm like, I'm a practitioner. It was a little confusing. And then the confusion was what I was identified with. And then the mind just said, I don't need any of this. And it just dropped all of these things. And it was just like, oh, there's no problem. I just kind of got up. I finished my meal. I got up. It was just like ease and changed my clothes in my room. This kind of sense of just being essentially followed me around for a little while. And then I was outside, went outside to do some walking meditation. And then the thought arose, I wonder how long I can keep this going. And I noticed that as a thought, and I kind of chuckled, you know, and then the mind fully picked up that identity. It's like, I was the one that had to keep it going, and I couldn't keep it going. And I just felt this like whole weight. It was like the whole, this burden of having picked up a sense of self. It was quite amazing to see that contrast. So seeing these different senses of self, there's lots of selves out there. There's not just one sense of self. And this is actually something that is useful to recognize. You know, these different experiences that we're calling self, do they have any relationship with each other? Sometimes they do, as in this case, the description, you know, one was the I am practicing was like, I am practicing seeing this sense of self. And then the identification shifted here. So there was a relationship there, but sometimes there's just a switch is flipped and there's just no relationship between this identity and that identity. And we really get a sense of the identities as being constructed. We get a sense of that. Another retreat, I was a food finisher on a retreat, and I was supposed to take the food that was left over from the table and put it into the containers and, you know, label it and put it in the refrigerator. That was my yogi job. And while I was scraping the pot, I noticed I was angry. I was like, oh, so there was that identification, I'm angry. And there was this imputation of it being, it's like, oh, I guess this is what I get to look at for the next few hours. And then I picked up the next pot and I was happy. And again, it was this kind of like, what? I guess, okay. I guess this is what I see now. And so seeing this like changing nature of what we identify with helps us to understand that what we are taking to be self is a misperception. So one thing, one kind of aside I'll offer, talking about exploring the sense of self, looking at it as a process, being curious about it. Sometimes we might, you know, hearing this, so the teaching where the Buddha said, you know, the sense of self is kind of intimately connected with suffering. We might, feeling some kind of suffering, try to like find, well, where's the sense of self in there? Or, you know, try to find a sense of self sometime. You know, what is the sense of self that's operating right now? We might ask that question. And it can be an interesting kind of question if it's simply a, well, what is the sense of self that's operating right now in that very light way? But if we're digging and trying to find it, first of all, there's an I doing that. So there's a sense of self kind of engaged in that. But also, it may not be what is most like obvious in this moment. Sometimes what's most obvious is a feeling of suffering. And the Buddha's teaching around the process by which the sense of self is constructed. He had a teaching around that. The teaching of dependent origination is a teaching that describes how the sense of self is put together and basically believed in. So this kind of process in the mind. And that same process, that same cycle, also is understood to describe the arising of suffering. And so whether we're noticing suffering in the moment and investigating suffering, investigating the feeling of frustration or anger, and you know, we don't have to find, well, who's the one that's angry? If that's not what's obvious, maybe it's just this feeling of anger. That recognition, that exploration around what's going on in that construction of that suffering, you are studying the same cycle, the same process. You don't have to find the sense of self in there. And likewise, if the sense of self is obvious, that's a great place and a great time to begin to investigate. And so there are times in the day where the feeling of, yes, I am, is really strong. When I know I'm right, or you know, various other times, they're just this real strong sense of self. That's the time really to begin to be curious about, well, what is this feeling I am? So the Buddha had some suggestions for us in terms of ways that we experience a sense of self in his great capacity as an analyzer, parser apart of experience, list maker. He enumerated 20 ways that we identify as self. I'm not going to go through those. But I will give you the basic flavor. So he basically said, there's four basic ways the 20 comes from, there's four basic ways or patterns of ways that we create a belief in self. And those four ways are applied to the five aggregates. So these four ways times those five aggregates, we get 20 ways that identity, belief in identity view, this is the teaching, Sakkaya Ditti, identity view comes to be in relationship to these four kind of ways of taking a believing a self and believing them around one of the five aggregates. So I'll just describe these four ways. So the first is, I am X. I am form. I am feeling. I am perception. So this comes in the ways like more speaking more familiarly, like I'm the body, the sense of this mutual, this self-identification. I am the body, or I am angry. I am frustrated. So around emotions, around mental formations, we identify, I am this. Then perhaps around roles, you know, the I am a parent, I am a sibling, I am a friend. We may have that kind of identification. And again, we see that these sometimes get picked up and sometimes not. But, you know, around roles, it can be really interesting to see this sense of self. You know, the I am with respect to being a daughter is a completely different collection of sense than the I am being sitting in front of this room, being a teacher. These roles, just different roles. So that's this first form. I am X. I am something. The second is possessiveness. Something is mine. Things belong to me. The body is mine. These are my feelings. This is my emotion. So this sense of ownership. And it's not necessarily about material things. It's also about our states of mind. I mean, we even talk this way at times. This is my truth. My truth is that there's this anger. This is my anger, and it's my truth. So we have perceptions. We have feelings. So that sense of ownership. Then the third way is I am inside of something. So this one actually, you know, this one I kind of relate to in a couple of ways. One way that I felt is like I am inside the body. Like the body isn't necessarily me, but it feels like I'm like somewhere in here. So I am in something. And then the fourth way is something is inside of me. So something along the lines of, you know, me being a bigger thing in which other things happen. So emotions are in me. So these four ways of, and so the Buddha just points to the ways that we take or ascribe, believe a sense of self can be seen in these 20 ways. Now, I will say that in my own exploration of the five aggregates, this is not a map that I use. I offer it because the Buddha offered it, and he was very wise. And yet, you know, so maybe at some point I'll find this particular map a useful map for exploring experience. I mean, I've done a little bit of exploration in this way of seeing, oh yeah, I do sometimes feel like I'm in the body. Or sometimes it feels like things are in me, or it feels like I'm owning things or possessing things. There's another three-part formulation that the Buddha makes that I find really useful around the sense of self. And this one I use a lot. So first of all, I'll just say, you know, I don't use this particular frame that much. I tend to just explore what is this experience and what's happening. So I don't try to parse it out in this way. So just to put that out there. But this three-part formulation the Buddha uses and often refers to, you've heard this over and over again, I'm sure, in talks, or if you read the suttas, you'll see this over and over again. The Buddha encourages us to know of experience, to know of the aggregates, to know of seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. And this is the order. It's the possessiveness is the first one. The sense of I am is the second, and the sense of something being me, the third. And for me, this is an interesting kind of teasing apart of different ways we experience a sense of self. This first one of possessiveness. This is mine. That one's an obvious one. That when we feel like something belongs to me, there is an I that believes that it owns something. And so this is this possessor, this possessiveness. So that one we can see. That one's pretty easy to see, actually, I think. The second one, and my understanding around the second and third here, this is my own useful tool with them. Other places I've read in the sutta, in the commentaries, have other alternative explorations of these. But this has been very useful, and I think it does point to something really interesting about the way we take a sense of self. So the second one is this I am. So, and to me, this brings in the sense of self as an agent, or I am the one who, I am the one who acts, who feels, who chooses, who decides. So that notion of the I am the doer, in a way, that aspect of identification, distinct kind of sense of self, that feels a little different to me than being the owner, than being the possessor, the mind sense. It's the I'm the one who chooses. I make things happen. That's a distinct sense of self. And the Buddha pointed to that around the agency piece, the sense of the one being in control of you know, form is not self. If form were self, it would be possible to say a form, may my form be thus. You know, that sense of self, the one that thinks it's in control, that chooses, decides, acts. So that's that second flavor. And we can see that sense of self. It's subtler to me than the owner, the one, the possessive sense of self. But it's still, it begins to be pretty clear, coming up with things like self-righteousness and, you know, the need to do something following on from an emotion or something. And then the third one is, this is myself, or, you know, so this, and we're encouraged to reflect, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And in the flip side, we tend to take, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. So this is myself, to me, that what this evokes is, at one point, and the reason this kind of came up, at one point, I was exploring the aggregates in my experience and began to recognize I was not in charge of doing the aggregates. They were doing themselves. Even the knowing, I could see I had no say in that. The knowing happened, the feeling happened, the perception happened. So I knew I was not doing that. But it sure felt like it was happening to me. And that kind of pointed me back to, oh, that. And I even went to my interview and I said, yeah, I can see I'm not doing this, but it feels like it's happening to me. How do I see through that? And my teacher said, just notice that thought. I need to see through that. So you know, that, but that feeling of it's happening to me, that's a subtler kind of sense of self. And that, I think, is one of the more enduring kind of ones that goes on. That it's happening to me. So there's, you know, how do we study selves? Just there's so many different selves coming up. And really, it's just what we've been doing. What's happening? Noticing the arising of a sense of self. And as I said earlier, it's useful when a sense of self feels strong. There's a strong sense of I am, you know, that I am right. That's a really good time to begin to be curious about, well, what is this? What is being called self? What is this sense? So exploring it when it's strong. And sometimes it may just be as simple as seeing it strong for a little while, and then noticing something else comes along, and that identity just goes poof, and another one comes in. As I was describing with my experience around the miserableness, and then that identity kind of going poof, and becoming the meditator. So seeing, so it's not like we need to actually go in and like pull it apart. Where are the aggregates in this? To me, it's so much simpler. You know, just a very simple exploration around what is this experience? And noticing the kind of solidity that happens, the feeling of just like, oh, yeah, really, feels like me. Knowing how that is, what that is happening. And then we can see that the sense of that shifts and changes. That very seeing of the impermanence of an identity can help the mind to recognize that that solidity was a construct. That solidity of that, yes, this is me, this is who I am, that it was a construct. Because we see in the next moment that we are something else entirely, and that whole thing is just like irrelevant. That whole first one is irrelevant. So there's some different, kind of identities that, I mean, we have identities around many emotions, you know, a certain kind of identification. I'm the miserable one. I'm the one that, you know, I hate myself, the feelings of self-hatred or senses of pride, or, you know, I'm a great meditator, all of these. So many, many things around emotions, senses of self's identity around emotions. Then there are identities that come that are almost broader than an individual. So some of our identities are related to our own personal conditioning, but some of our identities are more tribal, you know, they're related to family, so clan, tribe, that kind of thing, and this is actually a natural part of being human in kind of growing up with people. We have a particular culture in a sense of this is what feels comfortable, and sense of self kind of fits in with that feeling of comfort. So but what happens here is not so much this is who I am, it becomes this is what people are. And that causes a lot of problems in our culture, in society, is that we come with some conditioning, some identities that are broader than just kind of me. So, you know, the ways that my family works, the ways I was conditioned in school, whole senses of like how do cultures work and how do people interact with each other. So there can be identities built around that are not seen as identities because they're shared. There's a kind of a shared agreement that this is what people do and how they act. And then we come into contact with other cultures and there's a rub there. And often what happens because of that identification, we feel like this is the right way to be human and that's the wrong way to be human. So this is really pointing to the ways in which we segregate and separate, you know, through race and religion and sexual orientation and all kinds of ways in which, as a culture, as in various cultures, we have these creation of identities that relate to what it is to be a person in general, and then coming up against these other pockets of identities and views. It's like, well, one of them has to be right and the other one has to be wrong. So this is a real dynamic in our culture around identities, and these are harder for us to see, as I said, because we share them. And then in this process also around identities, those kind of identities, not only do we say, take, you know, this, so this is a lot where some senses of selfing and othering comes in. We do other in very individual ways. Just, I mean, we've been talking about this. Some of you have noticed that, you know, even walking down, walking through the hallway, you know, sometimes there's a sense of just walking by somebody and there's no whiff of any like sense of me and them or self and other. But then other times it's like, whoop, I come into being and the imputation of other comes into being and we feel that. And so again, we can be curious about the sense of when there is this sense of self, the sense of the mind creating other. So sometimes that happens on an individual basis, but a lot in our culture, it happens on these more, in the various cultures interacting, we have this happening on a cultural basis. So much suffering comes with this. And then sometimes what can happen too is that, and so, you know, we all other, you know, this is, we see this happening. Anybody not see othering happening? You know, it's very, you know, it's a human mistake. It's not personal. It's a human mistake that we do this othering and take that other to be what is there. Take that sense of the other that's constructed in the mind to be what's there. And a lot, again, a lot of the, sometimes what can happen around a sense of self is that it's not necessarily that I particularly feel like I'm a female, you know, I'm just kind of going through my life. I don't particularly pick up being female. But then if I walk into a room of men, suddenly it's as if I feel like I'm seeing myself through them, you know, so that there's kind of this, you know, this sense of that being othered. Just that, and you know, some of it may actually be, you know, some of this being othered actually gets solidified into policy and laws and all kinds of ways of, you know, navigating things. And so this being othered is not always just something that's happening in our own mind. It can actually be so the being othered is a construct of the mind, but it has real consequences in the world. And so I think it's really crucial for us to recognize this process at work, not only for our own welfare, but the welfare of all beings. And I think too, it's, in terms of exploring the sense of self, you know, the teaching or the framing of not self, sometimes we can pick that up as being, well, I'm supposed to get rid of these identities. But that's a kind of, let's see, which one of these is it? I perceive self with not self, perhaps. That not self is the primary thing, and I perceive self, and so supposed to not self that self. That is not so useful. I find it more helpful to have the perspective around sense of self and exploring it. Much as we've been talking around with exploring suffering, to respect that the sense of self is arising. You know, it's arising independence on conditions, and it's arising. You know, often our senses of self have been created because of strategies to survive, strategies for security, strategies to navigate the challenges that we have lived through. They're there for, you know, they've been working hard to try to help us and keep us alive, you know. So likewise with our dukkha, you know, very much the dukkha is often, it's a misunderstanding. You know, I talked about that misunderstanding with respect to, you know, the tangle between wanting to be safe, happy, healthy, and recognizing impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, and how those get tangled up. The suffering of that. Well, that's also the selfing, the same process at work. And so the sense of self also, and as we talked about the other day, you know, the mindfulness being the kind of lubricant or the maybe the warm bath in which these threads untangle, very similarly around the sense of self, holding it with a loving heart, respecting these arisings, but being curious about them as arisings, as processes, understanding that they are processes and constructions that have come about sometimes to try to help us navigate challenge just through mistaking that, you know, that needing to control, that feeling that I need to control it, that I have to do that, mistaking that to be a truth rather than a misunderstanding about where a deeper happiness can be found. And so in the exploration around a sense of self, I really find it helpful to hold it with a lot of love, a lot of respect and honor, honoring these identities, not to give in to them, but to hold them with that curiosity, because they are, you know, in this kind of model or description of the sense of self being kind of a construction related to that feeling like I need to control and I want to be happy. This tangle of the truth of uncontrollable, unreliable, and the desire to need to be happy, wanting to be happy, the tangle of those. And so the senses of self also, in a way, it's like observing this sense of self, observing the suffering, same process, with that kind of warm bath, the lubricant that can untangle the tangle. Every sense of self, every suffering contains within it some thread that will point us to truth, help us align with truth, and connect us with love and compassion. So again, it's not like, you know, this tangle, taking the scissors and cutting it out and saying identity bad. It's a confusion, a misinterpretation. The mindfulness kind of unweaves the confusion, helps us to see what's actually here in a very respectful way. So let's sit for a moment.